From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Chun Dingding, professor of international relations at Jinan University in Guangzhou, and non-resident fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin. Dingding previously taught at the University of Macau, and he founded 3 years ago a new independent think tank called IntelliSEA Institute, dedicated to international affairs in China. He has served as a visiting instructor in the government department at Dartmouth College and a China and the World Program Fellow at Princeton University. He earned his master's and his PhD from the University of Chicago. It's wonderful to have you back, Dr. Chun Dingding.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's nice to be back.
Dingding, the last time we spoke on this podcast, shortly after the election of Donald Trump, it was a transformative development in international relations, the election of Donald Trump. And you were one of a very few number of Chinese scholars to accurately predict that he would win the U.S. presidential election. When we spoke about the election at that time, you were of the view that the election of Donald Trump could be either very bad for China and the U.S.-China relationship, or it could be very good. We have a year and a half now into the U.S., into the President Trump administration. What is it?
Well, Paul, thank you. That's a very good question. Actually, as you said, you know, we have been a year and a half almost since the administration, and unfortunately, I would say things are looking in the direction of we are going to be very bad for U.S.-China relations. I mean, President Donald Trump is going to be very bad for U.S.-China relations. But I also would say it's not just because of President Donald Trump, as many people have already pointed out in many different ways. U.S.-China relations back in 2015 were already at a tipping point, according to, you know, Mike Lampton and many other famous scholars. So yes, you could say Donald Trump maybe is playing a sort of a facilitating role, in a sense that he's you know stepping up the gas and maybe putting U.S.-China relations in a sort of a speeding mode. In the wrong direction, of course, not in the good direction. So I would say both structural factors and these individual factors, including Donald Trump, are affecting U.S.-China relations in a negative way. But
so looking at the relationship, a little more focused, what are the things that in your view are moving in a negative direction? What are the things on top of the list? Obviously, you know, we've got trade, which is everyone's talking about today. But what's your view on that?
Actually, I'm not so much worried about trade if it's only a trade issue, because a trade issue can be, relatively speaking, resolved by both sides, as long as they can reach some sort of a consensus or agreement with regard to how to divide the benefits of trade. So that's maybe strictly an economic issue. But what's really worrying me or maybe some other people is the grand strategy perspective that both countries are now adopting that also seem to be in different directions. And those directions, I think, are a result of both domestic in the U.S. and also in China, developments and also international factors.
How do you see the grand strategy of President Trump in terms of his views on foreign policy? Where do you see, you know, what would you see as the main components of that?
I think, yeah, I agree with many people here that he or the U.S. government right now might not have a coherent or even incoherent grand strategy. They right. only respond to daily crises or events in a very spontaneous way. I agree with that. But I also think from the US perspective or Donald Trump's perspective, he has maybe one very clear idea that is America first. Mm-hmm. So whatever he is doing or he will do in the mm-hmm. future will come from this perspective. That means whatever he will do will or must ensure the national interests of the U.S., mm-hmm. not other countries, mm-hmm. including some of the traditional allies of the U.S., like Japan or European mm-hmm. or Canada or Mexico. So think maybe that's not a strategy, but I think maybe that's also, you can call it maybe a principle, a principled idea, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, my understanding of the U.S.
Yeah. You mentioned policy. There's not, there may not be coherency. And I would agree with you. It often seems that, you know, the leadership, the cabinet secretaries of the different agencies, whether you have General Mattis or, you know, previously Rex Tillerson at State, seem to be moving in one direction, and maybe Donald Trump has other inclinations, maybe moving in a different direction. I mean, a great example is this recent meeting with President Putin. The kind of things that President Trump talked about seem to be very much in contrast with what his DNI, his Director of National Intelligence, is telling him, and what other cabinet secretaries. And you almost have a situation where you have the administration moving in one direction, Donald Trump moving in another direction. Does it seem that way to you from a Chinese perspective? When you talk about the incoherence, what are you referring to?
I think that's part of that, but also my understanding is that a lot of the Chinese analysts do not see that the same way as many outsiders, you know, analysts or American analysts see Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They believe, yes, this is true. There are a lot of internal turmoil or whatever, different, you know, signals, contradictions within the government. That's true, but that does not, in a very broad way, change or affect U.S. attitudes toward China or U.S. strategy toward China. Because, like I said, 3 years ago, famous scholars like, you know, McLambda and others, they were already talking about a tipping point. And as of today, I think, at least within China, there is this consensus. The American analysts or American scholars or American elites have reached a consensus with regard to China, which is maybe they have different terminologies, but I think the main message is, as the most recent essay in Foreign Affairs, you know, demonstrates, this is a reckoning moment in the U.S. strategic community with regard to China. So something...
This is the Kurt Campbell, Ian Ratner piece.
Right. So basically, that may be a misperception, but in the Chinese community, they believe this is the emerging consensus in the U.S. So the main message is, we should be different toward China. So the old engagement policy or old whatever policy maybe you know, has never worked or will never work again. So we need a new policy. We need a new approach to China. What is the new approach? People are still debating, but that attitude has already changed.
Yeah. You know, a few of the things that you hear in the U.S. debate when you're talking about U.S. approach to China, and some argue it hasn't worked. Obviously, the trade and the economic relationship is one area people point to that say it needs to be, you know, fundamentally recalibrated, that it's gotten quite out of whack, and that, you know, there's not enough reciprocity, fairness. These are the kind of descriptions that you hear. President Trump now has launched $50 billion in tariffs, threatening another $200 billion. Mm-hmm. That's an awful lot for China to take on. China can't actually respond in a tit-for-tat way, because U.S. doesn't export $250 billion worth of products to China. How might China respond then if it doesn't have enough for a tit-to-tat retaliation?
We are looking at different numbers here. According to one estimate, of course, this is debatable between different scholars and analysts. One estimate would say the Chinese trade surplus with the U.S. is actually much smaller than the number suggested by many people, around more than $300 billion. The real number could be between 100 or 150 billion US dollars, which is, again, is a big number, but it's not as scary as the 300 billion number. And also, you need to include the amount of service trade, not just the goods trade between US and China. When that is included, the US actually has a surplus with China because all the service companies are doing very well here in China, so on and so forth. But I agree with you, if we follow the strictly the tit for tat strategy, then China would have no cards to play. Because
what in your sense is would make the Trump administration happy? What is, in your view, what does China need to do in order to satisfy U.S. requirements here? What are the main complaints?
I think, in my view, two things might satisfy Trump or his staff member or his cabinet member, because they have different priorities, goals in mind. One is obviously the trade number, of course. I think the trade surplus number.
Just focusing on the trade deficit.
Right.
President Trump does, even though economists say that's not an accurate metric to you. I mean, it's not an accurate, it doesn't work in a world of global supply chains to look at a bilateral trade deficit.
Right.
But you think that would satisfy him if China simply bought more products? Although Lioja just recently went over, and apparently they struck a deal where China would buy 100 plus billion more products from the United States. That didn't seem to work.
Yes, but I believe from now on, they are going to negotiate again between now and the election in November. They're going to negotiate, and some sort of deal, my personal view is that will actually emerge between now and then. But how long that deal can hold and how satisfactory that deal might be for
but
both sides.
But if Lioja had agreed to buy already 100 plus billion worth of products, Why do you think it got off track? I mean, I ask because I am unclear as well. If that's really what Trump wants, then why did the administration walk away from it and launch, what it's recently launched?
I think there could be two reasons. Mm-hmm. One is because the deal itself was not good enough.
I see.
Maybe the U.S. or President Trump was looking for a better deal, which is often his slogan. I want to get the best deal, not just a good deal.
Right.
Also, the second reason could be the deal itself was kind of vague, right? You promised to buy over 100 billion U.S. dollars for goods, but over how long, how many years, and in what sectors, in what industries, not detailed enough.
You mentioned a second issue that you thought would satisfy the U.S. In addition to China buying more products. What would the second issue be?
I think that's what China has been doing a little bit right now, which is to open the markets more to outside investors.
Market access.
Market access and broadly speaking, market access, but also more transparency in terms of domestic economic policy making. Mm-hmm. It's about the rules as well. So I think those things maybe are not like the grand things that might grab headlines, but they can add up and really change the calculus.
These are the set of issues about China joining the WTO in 2001 and still having many of their markets closed off to outside competition from the U.S. and other actors. And I agree with you. I think that for many in the administration, especially, I would argue, probably Lighthizer, the USTR, is one of his issues. The other issue, of course, and you were on a panel today at the Tsinghua University International Relations Symposium on the issues related to China's industrial policy, specifically China's Made in China 2025 industrial policies. And the panel I think you were on, looking at the issues of intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer and this specific policy, Made in China 2025, two examples that also, I would argue, figure into the ongoing U.S.-China trade dispute. What is your sense on that? How serious is this from this complaint from the American side and others in Europe some in Asia here? And how does China see this issue with respect to its own industrial policy?
China thinks industrial policy is a legitimate tool by the government to promote its growth or national development. China often thinks other countries like Germany, Japan, they have been doing that industrial policy for a long time. They're still doing that to varying degrees, of course. So in China's view, industrial policy is not a wrong thing to do. It's legitimate. It's a legitimate tool for the government to promote its growth and the national development. And China feels that the other side or US or other international actors are targeting China's industrial policy for some other purposes. But of course, China's industrial policy, including some of the new developments such as artificial intelligence, are heavily promoted by the government, partly because they believe that's the future. That's going to drive China's economy, surpassing other economies. So they have to use the national power to promote this new industry, because otherwise no market, no capital would be risky enough to invest.
So I want to ask you about artificial intelligence. Before I do that, let's go back for a second to Made in China 2025, because one of the arguments in the US and in Europe is that subsidies given by the Chinese state to these companies gives these companies an unfair advantage in the international market in terms of competing, and that China has the ability often to go in and buy high-tech companies abroad. They can outbid other competitors because they have the huge Chinese state behind it. How do you see that issue?
Well, I think it has two components here. One is, what are the legitimate means for a state or a country to promote its national power? So here is the debate. One school, maybe the Western school, would say you cannot use subsidies or too much subsidies to promote your industries or national development. Another school would say we do whatever we like because we are one state, we are one government. We do whatever we like as long as, you know, this would win some of the technological developments or battles, whatever you want to call it. So I think here is a very deep philosophical question. Mm. So what are the boundaries between the state and the market? Mm. And of course, we have terms like state capitalism, something like that, or socialist market economy, something like that. Yeah. So I think the fundamental question is that the boundaries are not clearly defined. So we have this debate right now.
Yeah.
But I think the solution might be, as long as we follow some clear and specific rules, then maybe both sides can find satisfaction in this regard.
I think you've clearly sort of narrowed in, I think, on one of the fundamental areas of tension right now in the trade relationship with the United States and between the United States and China, and also I think China and Europe. And you can see that because the first tranche of tariffs that the administration came out are, many of those are sectors related to areas in Made in China 2025's industrial policy. And so it's seen in the U.S. as an effort to offset the advantage that the Chinese state is giving those particular companies. You mentioned artificial intelligence, and I want to conclude by talking to you a little bit about this, because at Carnegie Tsinghua Center, we're going to launch soon a program on technology and international affairs, how technology and innovation and the impact of those developments on the area of international affairs, something you follow very closely. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about artificial intelligence. We hear this often raised in the context of the U.S.-China relationship. You hear some people say this will be an area for great collaboration between the U.S. and China. And then you hear some say, this is an area where we're going to compete or potentially have conflict in the future. How do you see this?
Paul, that's a very, very good question, because I very much agree with you. Technology seems to be maybe one of the deciding factors in the future competition or cooperation between states. And certainly China and the U.S. are included in this scenario. And to be honest, we don't know, because this technology is maybe so new, it's developing so quickly. We don't even know what would happen 5 years from now. We certainly don't know what would happen 20 years from now with regard to this technology. So a lot of the discussions today are, in my view, maybe, you know, speculations or even hypotheses. We don't know where the future would be like. But I think this is already grabbing the attention of all governments in the world. Yeah. And they are taking this issue very, very seriously. And, and I think rightly so. And because we have been seeing some of the beginning you know, signs of how this new technology can shape our domestic life or international life or international order. For example, the emergence of robot killers. Right. It's not being widely used or practiced in, during battlefields, but we don't know, because we cannot rule out the possibility in the future.
Robot killers. Basically replacing soldiers, human beings in a conflict.
Exactly. That's one of the discussion points earlier this morning when we held this discussion on artificial intelligence and the future of international relations. It is important, and to me it's worrying, because if robot killers become the future trend, that might increase the frequency of war fighting, because decision makers do not need to worry so much about domestic opinions, because domestic citizens do not worry about the loss of their daughters or their sons. They're only sending robots to fight wars with other countries. So that would lower the resistance level of domestic public opinion, therefore enabling governments to be riskier when it comes to war.
And at your planning, it's very interesting. And you were at your, when you were at your panel this morning discussing technology and international affairs, what were some of the other issues in addition to artificial intelligence and robot killers that came up that will have significant impacts on international affairs?
There were some hypotheses, speculations, if you will, about the future of the return of empires, specifically in a sense, because the rise of artificial intelligence will only benefit a handful of superpowers or great powers in the future. Because some developing countries, because they don't have the capital, they don't have the technology, they don't have the markets to develop this kind of technology. So only a handful of, you know, countries like the US, maybe China, maybe Japan and Germany, they would have this technology. And if
and
they are
not
willing,
give these countries too much of a,
an advantage. Mm-hmm. In terms of, for example, warfighting capabilities or even economic developments. You know, imagine in the future, the U.S. will not be worried about, or will not need to worry about the harrowing effect of a manufacturing industry, because a lot of those jobs can be replaced by robots, not by human workers. So you don't need to worry about all these companies moving out of, you know, U.S. to Mexico or to some other Asian countries, because they can have robots domestically assembling iPhones and cars, so on and so forth.
Many are here in China talking about this possibility of a what they call a technology cold war, and are arguing that the U.S. and China need to take steps now to avert what many have called this impending technology cold war. How do you see this issue of a potential technology cold war? How would this evolve? And, you know, what's the possibility of this? And how do we take steps now to avert it?
I think maybe the term itself is a little bit misleading. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but I do see a sort of a technological self-independence movement taking on or moving forward. So we are not really fighting war, trying to impede other countries' development in technological sectors, but we are trying to be more independent, be more self-independent. So we are not, we will not be impeded by other countries' technology or capital or markets or whatever. So in that sense, we try to promote our own domestic industries, but we do not hope to intervene or destroy others' technological developments, because that, if that happens, there could be real consequences. It could even spread to real Cold War, something like that, between two countries.
Well, Professor Chun, these are important issues. They're important now. They'll be much more important as we go forward, especially also in the context of the U.S.-China relationship. We're going to be expanding our examination of these issues, and I know that your institute, the Intellisia Institute, is also looking at these, and I hope we can collaborate in the future and potentially have you back on the China in the World podcast at some point.
Sure. Thank you very much, Pa. I would be very happy to come back and do some workshops together.
Thanks for joining the podcast today.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.